Is this on Twitter?
Yeah.
Frick, dude. Maybe I should get back on
that. Yeah. That's the reason why I kept it.
I know. That's all right. I can rebuild my brand in less than 6 months and have more followers than you again.
This temple I will destroy and rebuild in 3 days. I will destroy this account and I will rebuild it in 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, I'm supposed to be like Christ in all things. And the thing that Jesus was the best at, as we all know, is good branding. The resurrection really turned that whole thing around.
It really turned all that around.
Welcome to The Crunch, the only podcast that gets your tires realigned every 25,000 miles. It's your boy, Ethan.
I'm Patrick. That doesn't seem like enough miles.
26,000 miles.
No. Wrong direction.
How many do you miles. Think it should be?
20,
every 20 miles, I stop.
Halfway through my commute to work, I have to stop and realign my tires.
I have car repair on the brain because I went to, I was going to go to Stillwater, Oklahoma for the University of Tulsa versus Oklahoma State University football game. And I was going to watch it with my friends and eat bratwursts and also chips. And it was going to be fun. But the morning of, I see the little indicator on my dashboard that says low tire. And I said, I probably have a nail or something. So I went to the Midas and I said, hey, I think I got a nail in this tire. They said, great. I'm there for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. I hear the guy out in the construction bay. What do they call that?
I don't know.
The garage.
Yeah.
And he goes up to his boss and I hear him through the window. He goes, yeah, I'm going to have to call Honda. And I was like, what are you going to have to call Honda for? What's my tire has been off for 45 minutes. You haven't patched anything. What's the deal? Guy comes back in. He's nervous. He's shaking. He thinks I'm going to be mad at him. He's like, hey, so there was no nail, but the tire pressure monitoring system was on your tire. And when I tried to take the little cap off of the stem, I snapped it in half.
That happened to me.
Did it really?
Yes, the exact same thing happened to me. But then Firestone said, oh, this fell off.
Mm-hmm.
This was broken when we opened it.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, it definitely wasn't. I called the only other person who could have possibly broken my tire pressure indicator, which was the shop that fixed my tires last. And they were like, yeah, was your tire pressure light on? And I was like, no. And he was like, yeah, they broke it.
Yeah,
So did they charge you like $150?
No, they didn't. All I had to do was buy a new part and they installed it for free. So,
oh, okay.
Which was cool, but it just took 2 hours to get it to the Midas store. It's really hard for me to say Midas normally because I've said it every time I tell the story in person and not on a family friendly podcast. I say it wrong
on purpose.
Because the guy snapped it off and then, but it's all okay now because it was all fixed and I got to read a new science fiction novel in the waiting room and drink coffee out of a styrofoam cup. So that's how my week's been. How are you?
That your entire week was spent in the Midas store.
What a world that would be. Some people have to live that way.
I didn't do much this week. Well, that's not true. Yes, besides my job. I didn't want to be like, oh, this week
I came into the office.
This week, my core team started doing presentations at youth group instead of me. So my core team is now doing youth minister day-to-day things.
Mm.
I'm kind of like training them how to be youth ministers so that, like, you know, we can all take turns leading a day. So it gives me more time to focus on, like, big picture, you know, where's the youth ministry going in the future,
delegation.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, the most important thing for anyone in ministry to learn.
Oh, yeah. Why were you late to starting the podcast again? You had to delegate.
I delegated parts of my refuse into my toilet. Is that
that wasn't what I was referring to?
It's the best delegation I can.
But
manage.
Also, my core team is full of very holy, faithful people.
Mm.
We were doing a series on sacraments this semester,
right?
And the core team member who ran the, he talked about baptism. He was talking about signs, the sacraments as like an efficacious sign.
Mm.
So like a sign that does what it signifies.
Yes.
And the way he, and we're all theologians. We all know what that means, right? But he was trying to explain it to teenagers, right, which is not easy.
Did he
and
use
so what
the
he did
word
was,
efficacious?
No.
Okay.
That's what I would have done. Mm-hmm. But and then everyone would be like, huh? So he showed a stop sign on the PowerPoint and was like, this sign signifies what? And they said, stop. And then he showed a picture of a brick wall with a stop sign painted on it. And he's like, this sign says stop. And if you don't, it's going to make you.
Oh.
He's like, that's what a sacrament is. If you're traveling towards this wall, you're going to stop. If you're going to get baptized, you're going to be baptized.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's such a good analogy.
It's pretty cool.
You know?
Entering into the church's sacramental life is a lot like driving into a brick wall of of grace.
Of grace?
Where does the metaphor break down?
That's right, great, about, right at the brick wall. That's where the metaphor stops.
Yes. But other than that, man, we've just been big chilling. I'm enjoying the weather. It's a bit cooler these days. I get to wear my flannels in the mornings and then I take them off in the afternoons because I begin to sweat through them. But yeah, it's a grind. It's in that time where we're like 5 weeks into the semester and there's a lot of semester left, but there's like not enough behind us, or there's too much behind us to be like, oh, it's the beginning of the semester. Like we're firmly in what some might call the middle of the semester.
Some do call it that. I'm taking some grad school classes and it's been kind of a rough start for my on campus class because the professor was having some medical issues. So he actually wasn't there for the first 3 weeks. Mm. It's a once a week night class. And we missed three. So it and we finally started up the class. Instead of a moral theologian, a moral philosopher is teaching it. And so we're reading. I read all the readings for the class before the class started. All right.
Nerd.
And of course, a new professor came in and changed all the readings.
No.
So I know. You hate to see it, but you also, you know, love to see it. We're reading a lot more moral philosophy now. And that's interesting. I'm not exactly a philosophy boy.
Yeah. I also started some graduate classes.
Oh yeah.
Not really graduate.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess
it's post. Yeah, it's
I don't
post,
know what you would call it.
Education.
I'm doing a certificate that I don't have to do.
It's a certification.
For fun. But it's not, this is not like intro level stuff. I mean, it is. I don't know. But the one thing, I've only watched a couple of the classes. I think I'm going to be the delinquent person in my cohort because I'm seeing everybody else post on the page the responses to the assignment for the week. And I'm like, I've watched two of the lecture videos and out of seven. Help. But I've learned that we need to create a renewed pedagogy of the basics.
Yeah.
And that's all what I'm all about, baby. Catechesis.com/Ethan. My new website.
My new website, catechesis.com/Ethan.
You think anybody, Catholic Answers got catholic.com. We have the crunchcast.com. What would be?
Yeah, that hotly contested website. Anyway. The catechesis.com or catechetics.com at least is owned by Franciscan.
You're kidding.
So, no.
It's like how, I'm pretty sure the NFL like trademarked football or something like
football.com.
Football.com. There's probably some, yeah. I
think football.com goes to the NFL's website.
Try it.
Which is funny because football in other languages means soccer. Football.co.uk.
Back in the day, if you just went to some random.com website, you were at risk for some pretty sketchy stuff.
Yes.
These days, all the big corporations have gobbled them all up.
It's true. Football.com just goes to a website called football.com. But there was a... I remember this when I was a kid. So Club Penguin was obviously the most happening place on the planet.
Was.
But Penguin was a hard name to a hard word to spell. And so I misspelled Club Penguin and got a pretty interesting website.
Oh, no.
And I was like, that's not good. Unsubscribe. Unexit. And that obviously stopped happening. It's actually illegal now to make a pornography website or any kind of website, but especially a pornography website that misrepresents what it is. Apparently, a politician his kid happened to his kids and on the national level, and he pushed that through and made it law. And that politician's name was Mike Pence.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Right. Now he's the vice president of the United States of America.
And that man.
Little old Mike.
It was Jan Taranowski.
That man was Yam Turnsky. He's the man who's made of yam.
You really like that one TikTok, huh?
I really like that. My favorite TikTok is the Ratatouille TikTok. That's my favorite one.
The one where the guy looks like Anton Ego?
No.
Or the one where it switches to him throwing it?
Yeah, that one.
There is a good TikTok like of the guy's dad who looks like exactly like Anton Ego. And he dresses him up in a scarf and a dark turtleneck and puts eyeshadow under him. It's kind of crazy how a real life man looks like an animated dude.
Well, I mean, or does the animated dude look like the real man?
You never know. These things are always hard to say.
Yam Turnsky.
Yam Turnsky. Well, hey, do you want to do a podcast today or what's up?
You know what? I'm in the mood for a little podcast.
I was thinking that maybe we could record something.
Yeah.
You know, I've been thinking for a long time. I've always been saying, I even tweeted once, podcast.
I just tweeted the word. You know what? We've all done it. We've all gone onto twitter.com and just tweeted the word podcast.
I was explaining to some people in real life today what who Bruv was.
In fact, I just tweeted the word podcast.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
That's the kind of stuff that I miss about having a Twitter account is just being able to just do the absolute garbage stuff, like just tweet podcast.
I'm thinking about getting into some surreal tweeting.
This is not anything I would do anytime soon. This would probably have to be after I'm a team director because I would get too into it and it would distract from the mission. But after I'm a team director and I have a boring office job.
I don't think you're ever going to have a boring office
job. You never know. Get me a job. Get me a cool job.
Get me an office and I'll make it boring somehow.
If anybody out there in the greater Oklahoma area has a cool office job that I can turn boring, let me know. I want to get into that. No, I don't want to follow anybody. I will follow exactly one person. It's you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to tweet. I just want to tweet all the time and turn off all the replies and turn off all the stuff.
Uh-huh.
Is it possible to game the system that way and just girls just want to have fun, you know? Like, do you think I could do it? And also, do you think I should do it? Especially after our podcast last week, which is all about how social media is
girls
crap.
Just want to have fun and boys just want to have flan. That's what we just want. Mexican desserts, gelatinous cakes. That's all we want. That's my next tweet. Yeah. Boys just want to have flan.
Boys just want to have gelatinous cakes. Some of us already do. Built in.
Built in. It's me. It's my belly. All right.
This is great. Brandon McGinley, if you're listening, I did this all for you.
This is how we're introducing your book.
I'm the one that introduced your book. We're skipping the hot take time machine today.
Because we just got to get into a hot take book machine. Because
we're getting into the hot take book machine. And this is a book that I actually heard about on Clerically Speaking. So we have to give props to them, unfortunately.
We have to, even though they never give props
to us. Can I say something that's like constructive?
Criticism-wise?
Yeah. Or like a conversation.
Sure.
Did you listen to their Bishop Barron interview?
Yeah.
I was sad.
Why?
I thought it was going to be different.
So I think, first of all, I don't.
Patrick is
disagree.
Trying so hard to not upset anybody.
I don't want to get fired.
We're not.
No. I thought it was a good interview. First of all, Father Anthony and Father Harrison are great interviewers. I told them this yesterday.
Yes,
the other day.
They were very professional.
They're very good.
The videos on the Word on Fire YouTube page, you can't see their faces, which I find to be very odd.
That is weird. Bishop Barron has his talking points.
He does.
And that's that. I think that's part of it.
I was like, it wasn't anybody's fault necessarily, but it felt like they just had the questions and then their part of the audio was like cut. And then you cut to Bishop Barron just like talking by himself in a room. And like there was no real interplay between the two. And that's difficult because you're over the internet, you know, like it's hard to have like a dialogue where you're going back and forth. But I was just like, man, he didn't ever really say their names, you know? Like, it wasn't, yeah. It just wasn't really personal. And, like, that might just be the vibe that they were going for. And I don't know what the Word on Fire business strategy is. Okay. But, like,
okay, I think it's more of a critique of Bishop Barron than it is of them.
I don't think they did anything wrong.
Okay, cool.
I wasn't trying to say that they did. Did I say anything that made them wrong?
No, I just want all of our friends to be happy, and I don't want to contribute to them not being happy.
This is the fundamental difference between you and I, is that you're the people pleaser, and I'm the bridge burner, and we have to unite.
We are yin and yang.
We want what we want people is to love us while we burn the bridge that they're standing on. You know, that's the goal.
I do think that Bishop Barron is a bishop, and this is a problem that that bishops just have, mm-hmm. is that they really can't be personal.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's just me being cynical. Well, but like
I listened recently to the priests at K-State do a podcast called the Kansa Catholic Podcast, and they just had the Bishop of Salina on, and he was extremely personal. Mm. It's different because he knows them. He's like their bishop. Right.
Yeah.
So there is, you have to recognize that difference, but I do think it's possible. I just don't.
It's hard to build rapport over video chat. It just is. And so that's probably part of it. Also, yeah. I saw the little, I think Word on Fire was being a little too transactional with the way they were approaching somebody else's podcast. Does that make sense?
Yes, this is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, all right.
This is the way that Word on Fire approached Clerically Speaking is like they did not want to do Clerically Speaking on Clerically Speaking's terms, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to take Clerically Speaking's audience
and make content
and
with
make
it.
Word on Fire content, which I thought was wrong. Like I thought
that's not good.
It was not a good Clerically Speaking podcast. That's kind of what I was feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's okay to say, right? Like,
yeah.
Because
so Matt Frad and I were talking about this.
Okay.
He was talking about this podcast. And he was talking about when podcasts have guests on, it's different and it's weird. And he was like, you should just.
When were you talking to Matt Frad?
He came to Franciscan.
That's right. And you saw him.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And he was like, I just kind of want to smoke a cigar. You want to come? And I was like, yeah,
you're
sure. He's like, I don't have what. And he's like, I don't have one for you, though. And I was like,
wait, hold on. You got to smoke a cigar with Matt Frad?
No. You missed the part where I said he didn't have one for me.
So you didn't go?
No, I did, obviously.
Oh. Did you tell him about
our
podcast?
He bought me a bagel. We did. Yeah, we talked podcast.
What did he say?
Why did you
tell me about? Why is this the first time I'm hearing about this?
I don't think he listens. I didn't ask him if he listens to my podcast.
I don't care if he listens, but.
He listens to that other podcast. And We were talking about how like when other podcasts have guests on, you're like, I kind of don't want to listen to this one because the dynamic is messed up. So like I think that we can all as Catholic podcasters.
Does Matt Frad want to come on our show? I was just doing the joke.
I think we can all like how can we keep the vibe when another person comes on?
I think you just have to be completely transparent with them and be like, you're coming on and we're gonna do bits and goofs and gags. And we're just talking, and I don't want you to plug your stuff, which I might turn a lot of people away. But it's like, all right,
yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts, but they're all pertinent to this book. There's lots of things.
All
to talk
of
about.
These thoughts that you're talking about, Clerically Speaking, are pertinent to this book.
A lot of them are.
Okay. All right. Well, then we can keep it in.
This was kind of a lead-in.
Oh, do you want to start over?
No. This has been good. This is pure podcasting confusion, which is what we love.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of The Crunch. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a stimulating intellectual conversation, but I wanted to pause the episode real quick to let you hear from some of our sponsors. We will be back right after this.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah.
I was talking about, I heard about this book on Clerically Speaking.
Okay.
When they talked about this book on Clerically Speaking, I thought it was good. I read the book and I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much more in here that they didn't talk about that I want to talk about on our show.
Okay, cool.
Alongside with that, they had an interview with Bishop Barron, which coincidentally, I don't think intentionally, played into a lot of the things that Brandon McGinley talks about in this book.
Ah.
About, okay. About the bishops and about kind of the acquiescence of Catholicism to American culture. So, anyway.
I'm so excited to talk about
it. I love this book. I think you should read it, first of all. So if you could just stop the podcast, go and read the book, and then come back.
Patrick, when you texted me the title of the book, I knew that I should go find it.
Yeah.
But I don't know where to find it on such short notice.
I got it on Thrift Books for $13. So
nice.
I probably, Brandon McGinley, if you're listening, I'm sorry I didn't buy it from Sophia Press. But anyway.
Authors famously don't get a lot of money when you buy the book from the publisher. So.
Oh, good. Well, in that case, take that. This book is good. It takes a pretty honest and even-keeled view. Like, it does not lean too far traditional. Like, it's not the Benedict option. It doesn't... I know. And it doesn't lean anywhere that is unrealistic, right? He just starts by talking about how the American church got to where it is.
Yeah.
Talked about how to renew the church, the parish, the family, and friendships and community. And like those are kind of the things that he thinks that we should renew moving forward. Mm-hmm. But what I find to be the most interesting is looking at how we got here today. And he talks a lot about bourgeois Catholicism.
Oh, I'm so excited. Wait, I think I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yes, this idea that Catholicism as essentially a WASP religion. So WASP is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, right?
We get blamed for so much stuff.
Yes.
That is not our fault. Patriarchal, like sexism, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't us. We didn't do that. But right. Because we're considered a traditional religion, mm-hmm. We get lumped in with the,
oh, big lumping.
The waspy boys. Big lumps.
We always lump. He's got these lines in here. I'm gonna read a lot of quotes from this book because I just think that they're really good. And this is the most preparation I've done for a podcast in
this
about
is not a podcast.
Years.
This is an audiobook.
We're going to read this book. He says, this is Catholicism as WASP religion, going through the motions, or more importantly, being seen going through the motions, but lacking the real substance of religion as a virtue that permeates life. And then he goes on to talk about how back in the day, in the 60s, boys would ask girls to go to the Christmas Mass, and they would like buy corsages and all these things for each other. And when you look back, you're like, oh, that's kind of cute. That's kind of nice. But his point is that in the 50s and 60s, up until kind of the sexual revolution, right, and mm-hmm. the idea of freedom and peace and liberation from all that stuff kind of took hold in the Vietnam War and all these things. The church was kind of – there should be a natural social benefit to the church, right? Like that mm-hmm. will just yeah. come about. But when the church becomes completely a social functionary, that's yes. when you start losing out on these things. So you've got all these people who are like a part of the greatest generation, right, and you've got – Bing Crosby winning Oscars because he's in movies portraying priests, and you've got Archbishop Sheen on television winning mm-hmm. Emmys, and you've got John F. Kennedy in the White House, and then you've got all these Catholics who are like, wow, we're living it, we're doing it. I'm going to go to Mass on Sunday. I'm going to come home, and I'm going to buy the newest Chevrolet, and I'm going to have a fully stocked bar cart, and I'm going to live the same way as everybody. I'm going to keep up with the Joneses, right? But I also have this like cultural assurance behind me that like
cultural Catholicism
is, and, but it's not like cultural Catholicism as we talk about it now, where it's like,
which is like cafeteria Catholic.
Yes. Yeah. But it's like a genuine, like the gospel of Catholicism was enculturated, but not actually practiced as a real
yeah.
virtue.
And this is something that I inferred. I didn't read about it in this book, but it's something sure. that kind of,
it was, makes sense if you think about it. Like it's nothing
yeah,
crazy.
It's, that book that I was reading about race, the history of racism in America,
yeah.
talks about, yes, it's true. Irish people were discriminated against, and so were Italians. Why? Because of their Catholicism.
Yeah.
But assimilationism is a very American view. That's why we have the melting pot, right? Everybody just kind of melts into one amorphous blob of culture, right?
One world religion.
White Catholics.
One world government.
white Catholics were able to assimilate better.
Yes.
Because they looked like everybody else, yes, and they had the same general religion. They had this Christian religion. And so they were able to look and feel and act like WASPs.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, they lost their culture.
Right. Which
is why Pittsburgh is so weird to people.
Yes.
Because there's a Polish hill. You know, there's like a bunch of Polish people living in one area. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like in Newcastle, it's so strange to me because it's like most people here are Italian, mm-hmm, or they have a strong like ethnic hold on mm-hmm, and it's awesome, right? But yes, this is interesting. I like this. Keep going.
So he goes on and talks about exactly what you're talking about how Catholics are kind of among the WASPs, right? Like we're there, we're in it, and there's this assimilation that's happening. And he makes this point with JFK. This first line of this section, I just was like a big grin on my face. He said, "I really think John Fitzgerald Kennedy was one of the worst things ever to happen to the church in America."
Wow.
In a like, if you say that to our grandparents, right? They'd be like, "What are you talking about?" Right? Yeah. JFK was a hero. He was a martyr. He was Catholic. All of these things. Like,
and he slept with Marilyn Monroe. He spat absolute game.
Yeah. So he's the American dream boy.
He's the American dream.
And that's,
this is all irony, of course.
The presidency of JFK is the epitome of bourgeois Catholicism assimilating, mm-hmm, into WASP culture. And that kind of idea for our grandparents and their parents in those generations, right? It's really hard to get rid of like this idea of my faith is this sedated, yeah, punctual, courteous, stable, but most of all it's like practical, right? Like this is a practical thing that I have and that I can do. Like I'm not gonna offend anybody. I'm doing all the right things. Everybody respects me because I have the same faith as the president, right? So I mean if you don't respect me, then you don't respect the president, which means you don't respect America, which means you're not a good citizen. You know, like it's very safe, it's very, mm-hmm, whitewashed, and it's very comfortable, right? It's, yeah, it's like just living in not even a jacuzzi, but just like a 90 degree pool where it's just kind of like,
it's warm.
It's warm and you're in there and it's fine. And like, there's not any reason to like get out. There's not any reason to turn up the heat because it's just fine. You can have everything that you want. And was the reality for a lot of the 50s and a lot of the 60s. And he goes on talking about this. So that's the mentality that we inherited when we were raised in the church. Is that,
okay,
the faith is this, most of all, practical and private thing.
Yes. Yeah.
It belongs to you. And as long as you can do it without interfering with your work duties and your duties as an American, then you'll, yeah, be okay. And you'll fit in and you can be really rich and you can be really successful and you can have all the things that everybody else has and it'll be fine. That's the idea, mm-hmm, that we inherited when we grew up in the Catholic Church in America, which is, now that I know that, I'm like, a lot of things make so much sense because of that. I, yeah, don't think about JFK and like his impact on my youth group, but like that is all a part of the thing. You know, when I was in high school growing up and in college, like coming into my own as a part of the church.
It's kind of weird that he's buried underneath St. Matthew's Cathedral. Isn't that weird?
I didn't know that. That is odd.
He might not. Never mind. He's not. I'm remembering he laid in state in St. Matthew's Cathedral. That's what it was.
Oh, really?
I think all presidents are buried in the same place in Arlington.
Yes.
But there's a little plaque on, mm-hmm, at St. Matthew's Cathedral that said JFK was here. It's pretty much that. I'm like, that's kind of weird. Like, that's a little, it's separation of church and state unless, right, we want to memorialize a president who's not a saint, mm-hmm, in a cathedral, which is strange.
That is really weird.
Yeah.
Give me another King Louis. So he draws
which
this.
Which one?
I know.
It's very important.
The good one.
We want another King Henry. Not that one.
Not that one.
Not that one either.
He draws this distinction. So he identifies the bourgeois spirituality and then kind of contrasts it with the Baroque spirituality of Europe. So the bourgeois spirituality is this like sedated, punctual, courteous, respectable, responsible, practical faith. And he contrasts it with this Baroque European attitude, which is like,
yes, the Baroque spirituality. I know it well. I'm no one can see this, but I have my coffee mug out and my pinky. No one, you don't like the joke?
I don't like the joke. I'm trying to read from this book and also pay attention to you at the same time. It's very difficult.
Oh, sorry. Am I distracting you?
A little bit.
From your reading in the middle of our podcast.
I'm trying to do a show. He talks about how this Baroque spirit is ecstatic, unrestrained, effusive, the type of character that prefers to spend rather than to accumulate, to give rather than to gain. And it's the bourgeois is closed, the Baroque is open. And so along those same lines, the bourgeois is Protestant, the Baroque is Catholic. So you have immigrants and people coming over with this Protestant mindset. You have people coming over from this Catholic mindset. And even today, he talks about how people going to like Mediterranean Catholic nations versus like going to a German-influenced Protestant nation, you're going to have a vastly different experience of your time, right? He talks about how like the Protestant nations in Europe remain very like practical, unemotional, economical. But he talks about how his sister went to Athens in like Greece, which is still very Catholic influenced, and she danced on tables at a restaurant, and nobody ended up paying for their meal, you know. And like there's this thought of like, oh, you can have these hours long breaks during the day and siestas, whereas like the Protestant countries and the Protestant influenced nations are more of the you have an hour for lunch, you don't get any vacation time, you have to work, right? It's like the Protestant work ethic is
real. We were talking about this talking about this in my morality class yesterday about the Pelagian hypocrisy of Luther and how he was incredibly works-based.
Yes.
Like he was an incredibly, for someone who believed in faith alone, he was incredibly works-based salvation.
Yes.
And like, because the logical conclusion, right, is like, if there's no assurance, he looked for assurance of salvation, but there's a functional Pelagianism in Protestantism where no one's really sure that they're saved, like back in the back of their mind. Mm-hmm. And so they just do a lot of really good things to prove to themselves and other people that they're saved.
Yes.
It's like, I used to I have a friend who was a pastor, and I would talk to him about this, and I would be like, well, how do you know that someone is saved? And he's like, well, if they say they're saved, they're saved. You can't lie about that. I'm like, all right, cool.
Cool.
How do you know that you're saved? He's like, well, what if someone sins horribly, were they saved? He's like, well, no, if they sin horribly, like if they sin, like it's not mortal sin because that doesn't exist, but if they sin really bad, then they were never saved to begin with. And I was like, okay, cool, but isn't it possible for you to sin? He's like, yeah. And I was like, well, how do you know that you're not going to? He's like, at that point it's like, I mean, because I'm saved. And it's like this circular logic, like, well, then what if you sin in the future? The pastor before him was embezzling from the church. I would not say that he was saved under that Protestant mentality, but he told everyone he was saved. And so was he lying? How does that work? And it's like, oh, well, by your fruits, you eventually just end up at the same place of like, yeah, works are important.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, that's,
I mean, faith without works, right?
Yeah. But James doesn't count.
No, it's not. It's the Epistle of Straw. So that we have this whole idea going of like this, these different spirits that are moving through different parts of the world. And he has this quote from this essay called Catholicism in the Bourgeois Mind, which I might have to read at some point.
It's a very interesting book.
I love this book so much. So he's talking about the openness of the Baroque spirituality. He says, it is essentially hostile to the spirit of calculation, the spirit of worldly prudence, and above all, to the spirit of religious self-seeking and self-satisfaction. For what is the Pharisee but a spiritual bourgeois, a typically closed nature, a man who applies the principle of calculation and gain not to economics but to religion itself, a hoarder of merits who reckons his accounts with heaven as though God was his banker? Which, yeah. I read that and I was like my mind was blown open. Like he talks about how the Pharisees are this is how they lived, right? Is they had this spiritual bourgeois attitude of, I have this enculturated religion backing me up, right? There's nothing that I could do as long as I'm showing everybody that I'm doing the right thing, as long as I'm going to mass on Sundays, as long as I'm involved in the Knights of Columbus, as long as I voted for JFK, right? Then that means that I'm a part of the correct side, right? I'm on the right side of history, and then nobody can tell me that I'm doing anything wrong. That's exactly what the Pharisees believed, just about ritualistic Judaic laws, you know, and this idea of like cleanliness and all of these things. And I think that seeped in, and like we really are still trying to get rid of it now. Like there's it's something that's held over for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, it's astonishing to see. I mean, like, it's not. So I think where we're going from here, when you said bourgeois Catholicism, what I was picturing was not even necessarily the stifled yet successful church. I was picturing mega churches.
Okay.
Bourgeois Christianity as like mega church.
Well, I mean, and where are we now, right? Every Catholic church that's smaller than 500 families has been assimilated into a larger campus,
a larger parish
somehow.
Yeah.
So it's like you're not that far off.
Yeah.
It just took a while
and
to get there.
Part of that is there's a need because there's no priest.
Yeah,
but,
true. Well, this, I mean, that's a result of
this
mindset,
of,
you know, when birth rates go down, priest rates are going to go down because you have Catholics who just accept what the culture is saying about birth control.
Yeah.
And then
they're also contracepting and they're forming their souls through grave sin and they're unable to form their children to become priests.
Right.
So even the kids they have are screwed.
Yes.
This is kind of sad. Anyway,
it is sad. I mean, we have to acknowledge
it. I talk to people sometimes on my staff who are not in the staff leadership, thank goodness, but like who are like, oh, the Protestant church down the street, like they're doing so much. They have so many people on Sunday and they're doing all this stuff. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure. They have cool branding and a nice website, you know, like that's fine. But like and so what if our youth group is smaller than theirs? All right. They have 100 kids. Fine. But they're handing out Taco Bell gift cards. And that's the most that a kid can get out of their youth group. We're giving them confession and the Eucharist. And it's like, there's so much value in what we do that even if it's small, it's going to grow because that's just how God works. The Protestant mentality is not that works are not necessary, obviously, or the Protestant mentality is that works are necessary, but it doesn't take the next step. The Catholic mentality I was reading this book about sin in the Bible, and it was talking about how the metaphor shifted from a burden to a debt, and from Babylonian exile until Jesus, there was this idea of the debt that you owe God, you like overdrew on your account, right? And you need to pay back what you owe. That was like that's a metaphor that's used in the Bible for sin. But where it stops is you can never actually pay back the full amount. But what God promises that if you do this, right, if you do this thing, I will multiply, I will give back on, I will make it abundant, and I will pay myself back. So essentially, like that's the metaphor for debt. And the Protestant mentality recognizes the first part, that sin is a debt that we need to pay back, but does not acknowledge the abundance. And so
like,
when they see
the idea
any kind
of penal substitutionary atonement is that Jesus takes exactly the amount of punishment that he deserves or that we deserve on himself, and like there's no real, there's nothing beyond that, right? There's no idea of giving us the Holy Spirit to transform our human nature and elevate us and perfect us and bring us into the heavenly host, right? Like they might believe that we go to heaven after we die, but is there any sort of acknowledgement of once I accept the fact that Jesus bore all of this punishment for me because God was just so wrathful and he had to like deliver this punishment, you know?
He was just really pissed and he just had to like punch a pillow.
Yeah, like it's...
And that pillow was his son.
There's no room in that in that view. And I think a lot of people believe in that, but they don't know that they believe in it.
And so when Protestant churches grow and they see their good, right? They see like how much good they're doing, how many community groups they have, right? They go, well, we're doing so good. We're doing so well. And of course, Catholics should do things that are similar, right? But they do, okay, cool. We paid the debt back. That's the problem, is like we paid the debt back, and we can fall into that mentality too of once we do all these really good things, we'll pay the debt back. And the reason why God doesn't, and we see that mentality, we see them growing big, and then saying we paid the debt back, and it's like, cool, we'll pay the debt back, or we'll do all these good things too, because that'll show that we're good mm-hmm. Catholics. Mm-hmm. We'll do that too, but God doesn't let us.
Yes.
Because we are God's chosen people.
Yes.
Ultimately, the church is Israel.
Yes.
And Protestants are like Samaritans. They're part of the chosen people, but
yeah. This is why Benedict talked about how the church is going to get smaller, right? Mm-hmm. Because, and he talks about that in the book a little bit, is that we had that, right? We had paid back the debt, quote unquote, in the 50s. There were 8 masses on Sunday, you know, multiple daily masses, extraordinary form. I guess it wasn't the extraordinary form at the time, but like Latin liturgies, liturgy of the hours.
It was just the form.
It was just the form. Like,
oh, it goes back in time to the 50s. Oh, you guys going to the extraordinary form mass?
The what? Oh, what year is it? All of these things. And so in a common Catholic mindset, it might be easy to say, oh, we've paid back our debt, even if they're not consciously thinking that, right? We've done all that we need to do to give God his due, and that's it.
And now we get good things.
Now we get the good things, right? We get the Oscars, we get the Emmys, we get the president. And then God, because he loves us, allows it to collapse because it's a life of dissipation, right? There's no substance, right? When you have the president saying, I'm not going to allow my religion to impact my policy decisions or even his personal decisions.
Apparently.
And none of the bishops say anything about it, right?
Yeah.
Self-professed Catholic. He was the
and
golden.
It continues 50, 70, 60.
He was the golden boy, right? And he was, everybody knew he was a serial philanderer, but like nobody, none of the bishops said anything. So you've got this timidity that comes with that bourgeois mentality, because nobody wants to lose, no bishop wants to lose his mansion, you know? Ooh, scary, right?
It hurts a little
bit. It does hurt a little bit. There's so much. The
empires that go up in wooden shoes come down in gold slippers.
Yes. What?
silk slippers. That's the quote.
That's
from Hardcore History.
There's one other thing. So then you get kind of that you lose the salt and the light aspect. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, right? Christians are meant to be the salt of the earth, which we're bringing life its flavor. We're bringing culture its flavor. Catholicism especially, right, has a privileged place in this because we are the church that Jesus Christ himself founded. So we're supposed to be bringing the heat in a lot of ways to culture.
Bringing a da noise,
yeah.
If you will.
He drew this comparison that I just can't get out of my mind of the Augusta Masters golf tournament. So the Augusta Masters control to a T how they are perceived when they broadcast the Masters, right? Every blade of grass is accounted for. Every flower is accounted for. They've even fired CBS, like, announcers for announcing the golf tournament incorrectly. Like, they referred to the people watching as spectators instead of patrons or something like that. And they Augusta was like, you can't have those people commentating the Masters anymore because they're so neurotic about their brand and how they want to be perceived. There's only certain kinds of ads that can be shown during the Masters. They don't allow any other ads for other kinds of programming. It's only about the sponsors and the golf, and that's it. Mm-hmm. He contrasts this with Notre Dame, the probably most famous Catholic school in the country, without a doubt, Rudy, you know. But he says that's the problem, is that's the first thing that we think of is Rudy, touchdown Jesus, football, all that stuff.
And not Our Lady.
And not, yeah, Mary.
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. And he said Notre Dame has the same kind of weight as the Augusta golf course. They could say to NBC, hey, we're going to say a Hail Mary before each of our games, and you're going to broadcast it if you want to broadcast our games, right? Because they have that weight. Yeah. They have that power. But they don't. You watch those games, there's no way to tell that they're a Catholic school, that they're a Catholic institution.
The only Hail Mary in football is the one with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Okay. There you go. Well done. Yeah. So
I only know that because of the Heinz History Museum, uh-huh. Maybe.
So he draws this. That's kind of the last thing that we'll talk about from the book, at least super intentionally, is that the we're we got so comfortable, we got so timid, we got so used to the fact that we had a cultural status amongst other people, especially the bishops. And he really points the finger unashamedly and says the yoke of the institutional church falls on the bishop's shoulders, right? It is not on your shoulders and my shoulders, Patrick, to like fix the institutional church and fix all of these problems, right? That's, we're not bishops, and thank God that we're not, because that's a lot of responsibility, you know? So that's why we need to pray for them most of all. So there really was a huge breakdown in the institutional church in the 1950s and the 1960s that we're still suffering from. And there's lots of things that have happened, right? The abuse scandal, money scandals, people leaving the priesthood, all sorts of things, right, that have happened because of all of these things. And now we're in this place where we can't even assert our Catholicity. We can't even assert our Catholicism without being afraid that that's going to set us apart, when in reality, that's what we're actually invited to do. What are you looking at? What are you checking out?
Looking at the book of Revelation.
Okay.
Because that's always a good thing to talk about when you're talking about the church. So in the book of Revelation, starts off, it's actually a letter. It starts off with a letter to seven churches, and it talks about the seven lampstands of these churches. And part of the, something that this is something that I've been thinking about in the past. The reason I was so quick to open this up is because it was part of my reading for my Bible class. Mm-hmm. He talked about the seven churches as like the different types of church. So Dr. Bergsma talks about, for instance, Laodicea, I don't know how to pronounce it, as the lukewarm church. That's the famous one where he's like, you're neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth, mm-hmm. right? Smyrna is the persecuted church. Pergamum is the self-indulgent church. And so I was looking through this list. Ephesus is the loveless church. So it's like, that's the church. Ephesus was the church that was like very orthodox, but they were very loveless. And so Dr. Bergsma was like, this, honestly, dioceses and churches in around the world should be reading these seven churches and be like, are we any of these churches? And the message of the church to Sardis, the biggest thing is that John says to these churches, Christ says through John to these churches, if you do not repent, I will remove your lampstand. Matthew 18 says the gates of hell will not prevail against it. The church, the universal church, Christ makes no such promise to the local church.
God says, "Oh, I'll end you. No question about it.
I'll TKO just like straight up 360. No, and elbow. You know what? Yeah, look at some of these churches, and the lampstand's gone. Mm-hmm. Some of these churches did not repent, and they are ruled now by different powers.
I'm pretty sure that there hasn't been a public mass celebrated in Ephesus in thousands of years.
So what does orthodoxy without love give you, church militant? What does it give you? It gives you the Muslim rule you're already so afraid of, not because of doctrinal reasons, but because of, anyway. So here, you who have ears, let him hear. So the message to Sardis says that awaken, strengthen what remains. This is chapter 3, verse 2. Awaken and strengthen what remains and is on the point of death. So, like, there's a little bit of hope there, because he says, you still have a few names in Sardis, people who have not spoiled their garments, and they will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He who conquers shall be clothed in white garments. I will not blot his name out of the book of life. So, if we are in the Church of America, we who will remain faithful to Christ will be okay, but we have to strengthen what remains and is not dead, because there are things that are dead and we can't get back, and we should mourn that, but then strengthen what remains.
We should mourn it.
So what remains?
We should mourn it and also not try to get it back, you know?
Yeah.
We are not going to be, Bishop Barron is not going to have a primetime Emmy Award winning television show. He's just not. Word on Fire is not going to change the cultural landscape of American ideology. I don't believe that is. I think they do good work. Let's be clear. I think they say a lot of things that need to be said, and they interact with people that that otherwise might not be able to hear the gospel, yes, or hear intellectual arguments for the faith. I don't think that those things, Bishop Barron, Father Mike Schmitz, all these things, I don't think we should stop them. But I also think that we need to be honest with ourselves about what we can accomplish. We're not going to be Fulton Sheen ever again in America. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have Bing Crosby. Tom Cruise is not going to play a good Catholic priest in a movie anytime soon. And yeah, it's going to be theologically enriching. And everyone's going to be like, wow, amazing. Finally, we can, a film we can support. You know, like we're always looking for that sort of thing. There's not going to be.
Finally, God's Not Dead 17.
Starring Tom Cruise's dog. It's
starring DJ Tanner's older brother. Kirk Cameron.
There you go.
Yeah.
James Cameron directing. We're not going to get back to that place of cultural relevance. And I don't think that we should be super upset about it, right? We had it, mm-hmm, and it was the worst thing long term, right?
It was not good.
It was not good
for us.
Not good for us, right? Just look at the numbers. Look at the people.
It was kind of what the Davidic kingdom ended up being,
yes,
for the Israelites.
Right. And then what happened after that?
The exile. I wrote about this on my blog. Yeah. I wrote a blog post called The Catholic Diaspora. It was an okay article. Check it out. It talks about how we look back on the glory days, and like so did the Israelites in the exile.
Yeah.
But they looked back fondly on the exact thing that caused their decline. It's like there was rot there. Mm-hmm. People were sinning.
The flesh pots.
Yes. The flesh pots. It's a gross image.
I know. I don't even like it.
I don't like it.
Yeah.
Sounds pagan. So
there was
evil back there, mm-hmm, and that's why we needed to change things. So like the people that are like, oh, back in the 50s when, mm-hmm, men went to work and loved Jesus and women stayed home and loved Jesus, you know, it's like, oh, this is kind of,
yeah,
I feel like that's an oversimplification.
And that's the story of the Jewish people from the beginning, right? Because even in the first chapters of Genesis, you have people looking back, turning to pillars, yeah, of salt, right? You've got people looking back at Egypt, dying in the desert, right? Spending 40 years, mm-hmm, they don't get to enter into the promised land. You've got after the Davidic kingdom split up and was sent into exile, you've got people looking back and saying, like, oh man, remember when we were in charge, large and in charge? And then the Jews in the time of Jesus, who are looking back at still at that time of David and Solomon and saying, you know, we can reclaim this. You know, we just need to get out, yeah, from under the heel of the Romans, and then we'll be great, which is why they tried to elevate Jesus to being a king. Like, that's what they wanted, is because they were looking back and not forward.
And that's why they freed Barabbas.
Yes. Oh, it's just horrendous. And that's, we can fall into that mindset so easily, which is why I think the Pharisee comparison for...
The comparison, if you will.
Nah. For the bourgeois Catholicism of the late 20th century is really pertinent and something we really need to think about.
Yes.
And there's this kind of this last point that he makes of that the response, I think, is twofold, right? We need to recognize that there's a certain status quo that exists. But we also have to recognize that, like, now is there's always a time in history for the gospel, right? The time is always right to preach the name of Jesus. There's never a wrong time to do it, you know?
Yes.
Always is a phenomenal and amazing moment for the gospel to be made known. But now, if we're just looking, we're reading the signs of the times, and we're looking around at what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. People are searching for truth right now.
Yeah.
Right, people are getting frustrated with the lies that they've been fed by postmodernity. Even what we talked about last week, right? That whole social dilemma documentary. It's not perfect by any means. Right? It doesn't mean that everybody's all of a sudden woke about social media, but it does mean that people are starting to get fed up. Right, the things about,
yeah,
politics, the things about these elections, the things about institutional policing, the things about big corporate businesses that are controlling multiple aspects of your life. It's like people are starting to recognize, like, oh, maybe this isn't actually everything that I thought it was going to be. Maybe this isn't everything that I was promised, you know? And so people know that something's not right. And we can embrace the moment, right? And we can, like, use everything that we know about the gospel. We can take advantage of our individual holiness. We can evangelize to the people around us. And there's also this call that he makes in the book about reclaiming the mysterious and weird and incarnate aspects of the Catholic faith and like bringing that back into the worldview. That does not mean that every mass has to be in Latin now. That does not mean that women have to start wearing skirts down to their ankles and men can only wear trousers and fedoras, right? That's not what we're trying to say. But there are aspects of the faith that we have to reclaim. And we have to say, no, this is going to be a part of my life, right? He goes on in the rest of the book, talks about making the family a place of prayer, making the parish a place that's not just another social organization. He goes off on galas.
Fish fries.
Yes.
Fish
He goes fries. Off on fish fries and galas and says, if you've ever been to a fundraising gala for the church, it looks no different than a political fundraising gala. It looks no different than a Salvation Army or any other like nonprofit fundraising gala. People are wearing really nice clothes, really expensive clothes. They're eating really fancy food. They're getting full. They're drinking a lot of alcohol, and money is just flying around. Like, can you imagine having a church fundraiser for the diocese, for the seminarians, whoever, where everybody showed up and everybody was fed simple, simple food? Like toast, beans, maybe a little bit of salad, and that's what they ate. No dessert, no alcohol, right? People would riot. They'd be like, "Oh my gosh, this is ridiculous." But like,
they would say stuff like, "I give you my hard earned money, and I don't get anything in return." It's like, yeah,
that's the whole point. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yeah.
No. That's so the whole point. Is you should give without expecting. Yes. Without.
So I'm just.
You should. Yeah.
You and I kind of have a part in this, in that we directly work for the church. Other people who listen to this who don't work for the church also have a role in this. If we have to reclaim liturgical prayer, as in like liturgy of the hours, should be like a public thing. He talks about this in the book. Regular mass attendance throughout the week, daily, should be a regular thing. We need to change our lives and change our schedules and invite other people into it. Because if we don't start doing that individually, and inviting other people in and creating families that do this and creating neighborhoods and communities that do this. If we just keep the faith between our other friends that we know are Catholic and we all kind of have this thing, then we're just feeding into the bourgeois Catholicism. If all my Catholicism is I post on Instagram, right, whatever graphic that comes up, I make sure everybody knows, oh, hey, it's the feast day of this thing, you know, on Instagram. Like that is bourgeois to the extreme. And I'm just like tired of that. I'm tired of the Instagram faith. I'm tired of the Facebook faith and the Twitter faith that people just post these things. They're like, oh, I'm a focused missionary. Look at me. I'm a life team missionary. Look at me. Nobody cares. That's not impacting anybody's life at all, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we get so stuck in that, and we think that we're actually doing something. We're actually changing people's lives, but we're not inviting anybody to anything mysterious. We're not inviting anybody into anything that's bigger than themselves. All we're doing is acquiescing our faith and our culture, the Catholic culture, to the American culture and saying, I'm going to take these things and make them Catholic, which does not work ever.
Okay. Can I go off a little bit, a little pet peeve of mine, Franciscan? Okay. So, Chacos. Every gosh darn summer missionary that I've summer missionary that I met always bought Chacos and then fundraised their salary. And I'm like, you understand that those are $150 sandals and then you're begging people for money.
Yeah.
I don't understand. There's a
Apple watches.
Yeah. Are people,
the number of missionaries I see with Apple watches drives me up a freaking wall.
Yeah, it's true. You can get them refurbished, and we should assume.
You can also get them as a gift, but also if you get those things as a gift, you can sell them.
Yeah.
And give the money away.
Yeah. Are some focused missionaries and life team missionaries there for the aesthetic?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
And it's part of the issue. I think people become youth ministers for the aesthetic.
It's because we've created a brand for the church.
Yes. And I think that's because we thought we were supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. And we are not. I just, It's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
I am not saying that I have never done this before. I started a freaking Catholic Twitter account. Obviously, that was for the aesthetic. It's an issue, and it's pervasive. I don't like it.
Yeah, and I think unless we call a spade, these things are just going to keep continuing. And
it's not as a Catholic issue. No. I will say that it's the co-opting poverty as something that's trendy is something that happens in America. You know, tiny homes.
Yeah,
they're just mobile homes.
Van living.
Yeah, if you had a bunch of tiny homes together, you could call it a trailer park, and it wouldn't be wrong. But that one is trashy. The other one's like hip and millennial. Mm-hmm. You know, flannels are historically some like a garb of the working class. They're just hip, you know. They're in sandals, literally the cheapest kind of footwear, bare minimum. They're 150. I have friends who went hiking in Chacos. I'm like, you know, those aren't functional shoes, right? They're purely a fashion statement. I'm sorry. The Chacos are not
you really,
the point.
Yeah,
I
you
just,
really don't. Like
I
the
really
Chacos.
Don't like them.
That's fine.
I really don't like them.
I have a pair of Chacos, but somebody gave them to me. Maybe I should sell them.
I mean, they're not selling footwear is harder than selling an Apple Watch.
That's true. They are a size too big, so it hurts me when I wear them. So it's kind of like a penance.
Oh. You don't have that. Yeah, yeah. You don't have that little weird like toe belt thing
no,
they have.
No,
I
bent that down because it's just too much for me. I only wear them when I go to the beach anyway. So, one way or the other. This whole rant and all of these things, this book is great, and there's lots of things that he talks about of how, like, what we can do at the parish level, at the institutional church level. He goes off on the USCCB in the book, which is really funny. He's like, I don't know what the point is. The left think that it's an arm of the Republican Party. The right thinks it's an arm of the Democratic Party. Just annoying everybody doesn't mean that you're doing the right thing as an organization. I was like, yes, that's phenomenal.
Brandon, can we be friends? Yeah. That's the best take on the
USCCB.
That's the
only take that anyone needs. Yeah. I'm not saying that we're perfect, right? There's lots of things to talk about. The family, the parish, the church, friendships, right? All of these things need to be renewed, and we need individual attention to all of them. And we need to bring a true Catholic spirituality to all of them. The last thing I'll say on your point, I hate taking business strategies and applying them to church in evangelization,
yes,
as if it's just a one-to-one, slotted in, slotted out, this is all that we need. Your youth ministry, not you, but people who are youth ministers, your youth ministry is not, you're not going to benefit from Gary Vaynerchuk's advice. This is not all about work. This is not all about investing correctly. This is not all about all these atomic habits, right? These are not like the things that are going to take your business to the next level, except instead of saying business, I'm going to say ministry because I am a Catholic and I am doing the right thing. I'll just go ahead and say it's satanic to take these business things and apply them to the church because we're reducing the power of Jesus Christ. We're saying, actually, I can control things in a way better than you, God. I can control this
it
in
is
a way
good,
better than
it
you.
It is good to take these business books and apply them to you because it's good human formation.
Yes, there is a difference.
I want to qualify that. I think that's the classic Luke Carey conundrum, mm-hmm, is he constantly goes, I feel it. I've been thinking about it recently. And we've now gone the gambit and name dropped everybody in the world, so we might as well name drop Catching Fox as well. He talks about like I don't like SMART goals or like any of that future planning nonsense. It's like I get that. I think there's something good there, obviously, because people have built good, successful businesses on these principles. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more because it's about disciplining yourself, and grace builds on nature.
Yes.
But you can't apply it to the church.
Right. We can't just get a PR manager for the diocese or for your apostolate or for any individual parish and say, oh man, if we just manage the brand image of the church, we're going to figure out if we just put the fundraiser on the right day so that people, it's not too close to the holiday season, not too close to the beginning of the school year, so that we can maximize the amount of money that we're getting. It's like we're just taking all these things, we're stripping away any potential to depend on Jesus Christ. So that
a great example of this is in How to Lead When You're Not in Charge, the author talks about how their church solved the problem of low church attendance on Memorial Day by canceling their Memorial Weekend service.
That's one way to do it.
I'm like, yeah, that's one way to do it. You could really solve the church attendance problem by not having church. But yeah, we can definitely tend to think like that. I think someone who does a really great job of applying honest business principles to the church is Patrick Lencioni.
Sure.
Because he says, like, he talks about good businesses have good values, but the Catholic Church has values already imbued in it. You can't choose them.
Right.
And I think that's the problem, is that we take the business principles and we apply them incorrectly, or we take outdated business principles and try to apply them. Like, churches think they need rigid organizational structure, so they over-organize their organization the wrong way, or they think they're supposed to have staff meetings, so they have a long ad hoc staff meeting every Tuesday.
You all right? You need to take a minute.
I don't go to that meeting, so I don't need to worry about it. But I was trying to keep it abstract.
Sure.
Listen, my parish is great, and we're doing good things. But sometimes meetings are meetings, you know, but they could be better.
Yes.
So, like, we can take business principles and apply them to church things, but not the church.
Yes.
So that's what you're saying.
And it's all about looking at it as, oh, if we just did this, then we'll increase our numbers. If we just did this, we'll increase our donations. If we just did this, and it's taking on the American culture, the American corporate culture, and saying we're just another 501(c) among many, and there's nothing special about us.
We're a charitable trust, so that's different.
Whatever. there is something different about the Catholic Church. Something different than
God. I hope
so. Something different than all of the
spent 5-6 freaking years studying.
I know.
It, so I bet
something different than all the Protestant churches. Something different than all of the soup kitchens out there that are just soup kitchens. The Catholic Church is the safeguard of truth and the channel of grace that Christ instituted when he was here, right before he ascended into heaven. Right. He left us a way to know the truth, to know him definitively without question, and he left us a way to be in relationship with him definitively and without question. And when we lose sight of that, and we're like, how can we make sure that we are culturally relevant? How can we make sure that our social media game is popping off? How can we make sure that we're doing this, that, and the other thing? It's like we're losing sight of why we're here. We're losing sight of what we're doing. Those things don't matter at all. I don't know. Frustrated.
We are not a soup kitchen.
We're not.
We're bigger.
Yes. Should we have soup kitchens? Yes.
Yes.
But that's not all we are. If we just reduce the church to just this or just that or just the other thing.
Just soup.
Just soup. Church soup.
You want some Dr. Ethan Zadon Corn?
Yeah.
Make this an extra long episode.
I'm sorry for yelling.
No, it's good. We talked about a whole topic for an hour, which is a long time. So let's hop in to Dr. Ethan's dating corner real quick, because we got some good submissions.
Just one.
Just one.
We need to save. Like, we need to save what we have.
People are sending them.
They're coming in spades.
Will Bonder sent us in one from Reddit, so I'll save that one because we could just find it on our own. Okay, in that case, I'll do this one because this one seems interesting. All right. Hello, Dr. Ethan, his esteemed medical assistant, Pat. Feel free to use my name on the podcast. What's a podcast?
I don't know.
That seems like two things.
It sounds like he's trying to say pod.
Yeah, but then he like, keeps sneezing like podcast.
Also, what did he call you?
Your esteemed medical assistant.
What was the third word there?
Esteemed.
No.
Assistant.
There it is.
Oh. Esteemed. Sorry, that was the third from the end. That was the first word. I am a 22-year-old elementary teacher, so you can imagine just how many young men I run into on a daily basis. I think this is a woman.
Young men as in students? Five-year-olds?
Yes, answer, none older than the age of 8. I joined Catholic Match begrudgingly earlier this year and didn't have too much luck. However, I met someone on there. Oh, my gosh. I met someone on there the last month or so. Let's call him Melchizedek.
Okay.
He's 24 and very, very kind, a faithful Catholic man, etc. He does have long hair, which is not my thing, but I'm allowing it. However, I have noticed a few red flags, besides the hair, obviously.
Yeah.
We have not met yet because of distance, 8+ hours. Mel is planning to come out to meet me in October. However, the conversation has been getting increasingly intimate. What started as kind of a joke, calling each other pet names, has now become a legit thing. Baby, sugar, babe, darling, etc. Mel has also said some things that have some, how do you say, sexual undertones. Here are four examples.
No! Four. Here are
16 red flags that I came up with just today.
Six. I've heard of four flags, but never mind. When we meet, okay, this is example number one. When we meet in person, it'll probably be hard to keep our hands to ourselves. Kissy emoji. When talking about pet names, I thought we were still joking around, but then he said, I don't want to say it. I can think of some naughty and dirty ones, but I'll save those for later.
No.
This one happened yesterday. We were talking about naps. Okay, next one.
No, say it.
You know what he's going to say. Baby, you taking a nap without me?
TikTok.
This one happened yesterday. We were talking. He said, we were talking about naps, and I said I was surprised he hadn't taken one that day, and he said, me too, want to take one. And, she said four examples. That's only three.
It's the content of four examples.
All that cringe. These are all very much exceptions to the way he usually
talks. No, they're not.
Okay. It's not, but here's the thing. It's not an exception to the way he thinks.
Yes.
Okay.
He's letting the walls come down. Finish what she says.
None of these things have been when we're speaking face-to-face, mm-hmm. just through mm-hmm. text. Oh, he's also a little wimp. Uh-huh. He's getting a master's in theology and is so fantastic.
No.
Just these few comments have made me feel icky.
Melkies.
All of these times I've tried to play it off as a joke, making comments about boundaries and being cheeky. But I'm wondering if by not telling him straight up these are making me uncomfortable, especially considering we haven't met, this is somewhat my fault. Don't victim blame yourself.
You're fine.
I don't want us to meet in person and have big issues because chastity is important to me. Are these such big issues I need to break off this thing? Do I address it? Please help, as he will be coming out to see me not too long from now. Oh gosh, I hope we're good. Thank you, God bless. I've been a fan of the pod forever. Okay, she said pod right that time,
not last time.
Yeah. What do you think, Dr. Ethan?
Munciate. What does that spell? Communicate.
Did you type out the word communicate before you?
No, I did it in my mind.
Nah, you're joking.
No, I did. No, it's hands up.
Hands up doesn't keep you from having typed it earlier.
My hands are here now, which means they weren't there before.
Before.
Which is what Melchizedek will probably say if he comes in person and gets his way. This, I got to tell you, this guy, it's so telling that he only says these things over text. And it's so telling that he seems perfect in every other way. These are his real, genuine thoughts. These are not exceptions.
Yes.
If they make you uncomfortable enough to write into a comedy podcast that's also sometimes about the church...
Whatever. That's our iTunes category. I know. Comedy podcasts that are sometimes about the church. We're number one.
If that makes you question enough to write into our show, then there's probably something that you need to talk to him about. And you have to address it head on. You have to take those examples and say, hey, you said these things. This is not just like...
These three, and there's probably another one.
This is not just one instance of him like saying something that was maybe imprudent and him apologizing for it. Because that's fine, right? Guys are wounded. They have weird ideas about relationships. In my life, I've said weird things and I've had to go back and apologize and be like, yeah, that was coming out of a different place than where it should have been coming out of, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a totally different story. But if he's saying these things full bore, no apologies, just like kind of raring to go, I think you're in perfectly within your rights to say, hey, Melchizedek, you've said this and this and this, and they've made me feel this way. And give him a chance to explain himself, but also be very firm and say, this is not the kind of relationship I want to have. And if this is how you're going to act when we're together, I would rather you not come and visit me. and just let it, just lay down the hammer, because this guy's been indulged in his double life Catholicism for too long. Like, somebody, there have been lots of women up to this point who have just kind of tolerated it. And like, somebody has to tell him, and men too, somebody has to tell him, this is not okay. You might have to be that person, and it might mean the relationship ends. But it's better for both of you, really.
It's,
gosh, that sucks.
I'm trying, like, I don't want Dr. Ethan's dating corner to become a man bashing session, obviously.
No.
Of like, oh, guys suck. But this kind of sucks.
This does suck. This is not fun.
This sucks a lot. He's definitely, like, based on the, I'm assuming you have the receipts, because again, he's never said this in person. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between flirting and like soliciting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
there's a difference
seems
between
like
flirting and saying things for your own benefit.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like he's saying these things because he enjoys it. Do you know what I mean? Len, that's a problem.
Yes.
He shouldn't be doing this. And he should also know better if he's studying theology at the graduate
level. Also, if he's 24.
And 24. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's double. Yeah.
Not a lot of comedy there, but this is like a really weird thing.
Yeah, it's what we in the business call porn brain,
just
to call it what it is. It's this idea that like normal everyday interactions are sexualized. Mm-hmm. Like when we meet in person, it'll be like there's a lot of stuff there. He's
and
saying that
not necessarily his fault.
Yeah.
And so giving him an opportunity to like repent and challenge him in that and say, you have to be better. You know, you need to be Romans 12:2, transformed by the renewal of your mind before you can date me, because I'm an elementary school teacher and I don't take none of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's really good for him. And it's really good for you to assert yourself in that way because you're a lady.
Yeah. It's also not your fault.
No,
like,
don't blame yourself.
If you're like, you know what? I don't want to be the person that has to teach him what's right. That is also your prerogative. You can just break it off. That's totally fine. You can say, hey, you said some things that made me uncomfortable. This is what it is. And I just don't want to like hear
it. You don't have to give him a chance to do anything. You can just.
Yeah, you don't have. Yeah.
You can just block his number.
You're also allowed to ignore it. That's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, maybe a fun one.
A fun one? Yeah. Yeah. I haven't read this
great.
One.
Great. It always goes
one.
Out,
so,
goes well when you don't read them beforehand.
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Ethan and Professor Pat. I am a first year focused
assistant
missionary
Pat
with two pairs of Chacos and an Apple Watch. And naturally, I'm on a dating fast. However, I have a feeling that some of the men at the Newman Center do not know that. They have been very flirty. One even asked me out. Okay, yeah, so he obviously doesn't know. Or maybe he does. My team and my team director agree that I haven't been flirting with them. And it's not like I hang out with any men outside of Newman. I do know that a strong women's ministry can help the men's ministry, and I'm not trying to model male friendships to my students, but how do I do that while making it clear I'm not interested in dating any of them? Also, I don't want to go around telling these men I'm on a dating fast. I made sure not to mention it, because I don't want them to hold on hope or ask me out when the dating fast is over. Thank you. Yeah. That's good
so
instincts.
So I have three first years on my team. I'm glad that you're asking this question, because if any student, especially a guy student asked out any of my girl teammates, I'd be like, go see what happens.
Why?
Just because, imagine this scenario, right? The team,
Dr. Ted Shree shows up at your house the next day. What did you do?
Explain yourself.
Curtis Martin goes, you are decidedly not on fire. Yeah.
I would get the whole team in on it, right? This works great if the student that asks you out is like friends with the team. If he's not, then this is like bad, because
are you suggesting they all show up standing at the table like the delightful children from down the lane?
Hello, Nigel. no, I think it'd be great if it's like you go to this restaurant, he sits down, he's nervous because he knows. It also be funny. This is the ideal funny scenario for me. You say yes. He sets the time. He picks you up. You mention in the car that you're on a dating fast. So that way, he is now confused, and you're on the way to dinner. You sit down. The three missionaries are already there. You pull up a table. Then the five of you are there sitting, and this guy is just has his head blown off. He has no clue what's going on. And then you pay for his dinner. That would, in my mind, is the best way to handle that situation. Or you could just say, hey, I'm not dating anybody right now. I think
that'd be so funny.
Depending on, I mean, obviously.
How would you feel if someone did that to you, though?
I'd be like, you know, that's fair.
That's pretty
funny. No, don't do that. Don't do that. That'd be mean. But as a team director, just like imagining one of my like little 18-year-old freshmen asking out one of my 23-year-old teammates, it's just funny. Like, it's just, it's hilarious.
Go. See what happens.
Go. Just do it.
It's not like you were saying, oh, if you want to do it, you
no,
can.
No, not if you
want to
do
it.
I'm
going to get
you. No. Not if you want to do it. Not like, oh, I dare you. But like, I mean, who knows?
Who knows?
You're on a dating fast. It's okay to let people know that you're on a dating fast and also say, hey, I don't plan on dating my students after my dating fast is over. Like, that's a weird breach of conduct.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that your instinct.
Excuse.
Yeah, I would just say I actually wouldn't use the professionalism excuse because that can also engender like, oh, if I wasn't your student. You know, it's like, that's the thing. You can't set up any barrier except for
Rick. You're just so hot. It's just that I can't date hot guys, you know, and that's the problem.
If only you weren't hot.
If only you're ugly.
Then he's going to get hit by a truck on purpose.
If
not the people who've been hit by trucks aren't hot.
I can't date guys with all four limbs. Sucks.
Sorry.
Too bad.
Sorry.
Please, where are you going? Stop walking towards the train tracks. Come back. Anyway. Nah, you'll be all right. Every first-year girl has to go through this in one way or another. I would just say let your team know about it, and then let the guy know, like, hey, I'm not dating anybody right now. It's okay to talk about the dating fast, and it's okay to say I don't plan on dating you or anyone after my dating fast is over. And guys just need to be rejected by women 5 years older than them. That's kind of...
It's just that...
I went through it. Yeah. Patrick went through it. And
I did not, but did you?
Huh?
Yeah? What? Did
let's
you?
Let's do a different topic of the for the rest of the podcast.
Well, that's all we got. So the different topic is just us going back to life.
Did I yell too much on this episode?
You did
I
not.
Critique the institutional church? And by that, I mean Bishop Barron too much. Okay.
No. Bishop Barron is the best American bishop. Bishop Umbers is the best bishop.
Is Bishop Barron the best American bishop?
Yes.
Hot take.
I like him. I like him the best.
He's the one with...
Move over, Archbishop.
Come on. You got it.
I don't know any other bishops.
He's the one with the best YouTube videos.
The one with the best YouTube comments.
Can you imagine if another like Bishop Olmsted just came out of left field and just was smashing like a million subscribers in like a week? Bishop,
he's like doing collabs with Jake Paul. He's like Mr. Beast is like, I bought a $1 million Bishop's mansion and look what happened.
That'd be so funny.
Oh man, he's like skydiving with I don't know. I don't know any other YouTubers. He's doing commentary videos with Cody Ko. That's the other.
Pretty
it's
good.
Just, yeah.
Pretty good YouTube reference. Lore.
Yeah.
Lore.
So, yeah, I think that Bishop Barron is, out of all the American bishops, he's the one that I feel like you could anybody could sit down and have a conversation with, and he would be willing to talk to you for an extended period of time. I think that he would miss a meeting to talk to an atheist just because he walked into his office. I think that's what Bishop Barron.
And I appreciate that.
Now we need more bishop. We need more bishops with that
we need,
quality.
That's a Baroque bishop, right? Not being on time to things is a part of the spirit that he was talking about.
Baroque, not broke.
Hey.
And a little broke.
You know, that's pretty good. Patrick, do you have anything else for the people?
Catholicism. It's bigger than soup.
Thank you all for listening. Please pray for us. We will be praying for you, and we will see you all next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.